Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 2:30 p.m. that is Central Time. Today is December 17th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And it was certainly a week of eventful moves in interest rates. So the Federal Reserve has clearly stated that they are going to accelerate the pace with which they are tapering monetary accommodation, and they expect to be done with it by March. And at that point, they will then determine whether they are going to raise interest rates or not. But they are potentially going to raise rates as many as 3 times next year. And 3 interest rate hikes in a year is a lot. And particularly when we have so much uncertainty about the global economy, and the uncertainty as well about what the debt markets are going to do and how everything is going to coalesce after the pandemic has finally welded its way through, or wended its way through, the entire globe. And of course, we're still looking at the Omicron variant, and the range of possibilities continues to widen. So on the one hand, you have news that potentially the number of cases in South Africa is peaking. And then, of course, you have other statements saying that the virus can circumvent previous infection with COVID. So obviously those are 2 important points. But the initial suspicion was that the Omicron variant was not as deadly as the Delta variant, and that was probably good news. But there's a sufficient amount of uncertainty still circulating, and most particularly about the interest rate sensitivity of the wider economy. Because we have to remember that prior to the pandemic, it was already looking quite likely that we were going to have a recession, that high yield spreads were starting to trend higher, and they had been trending higher for a while already, and we'd had an inverted yield curve had already been present. And stock markets had been through a 10% pullback, then a 20% pullback, and then they had rebounded. So it was looking pretty hairy for the outlook for 2020. And then we had the pandemic. So what the pandemic did was it forced central banks to be extremely quick in terms of how they deal with problems. And they cut interest rates to the bone. And then what they also did was they had a moratorium on people being evicted. They had then significant resources were made available to the banking sector, so that we had the PPP loans, and that avoided a mass default in the corporate sector. Now, I don't think anyone for a moment was anticipating that there would be an event like the pandemic in 2020, but there were certainly pressures coming to bear in the credit sector. And the response to the pandemic ensured that the corporate sector was given, or was it afforded, the opportunity to refinance at extremely accommodative rates. And then the quantity of money that was provided to consumers was beyond the expectations of anybody as well. So that has padded the pocketbooks and the finances of large numbers of people. So even though we've been through an extraordinary year, the number of credit card delinquencies hasn't been trending higher. In fact, it's been trending lower. People have been paying down their credit balances over the course of the last 18 months. But that doesn't mean there hasn't been an awful lot of debt taken out, and all that debt has been concentrated in the sovereign sector. And that has only increased the interest rate sensitivity of the sovereign. But the corporate sector is comparatively healthy from a credit perspective. Even though valuations are high, the credit situation has improved considerably, and the retail sector is also in a pretty strong position. And we're at a point really where anyone who wants a job has a job. Now, Obviously, there are mitigating circumstances where people don't want to work or they feel inhibited from working because they're worried about the pandemic or they're worried about childcare, they're worried about wages. But there is a job available for anyone who wants to work most places. So we're approaching a point where central banks are beginning to think about raising interest rates because they're worried about inflation. And they are looking at the economic expansion and they're happy with that. But at the same time, they have to be sensitive to the pressure that's going to come to bear on the sovereign sector, because the corporate sector has already refinanced and the retail sector has already reduced some of their debt. So they're both in a pretty sound position. It's the sovereigns are going to have the biggest issue with rising interest rates. So at the 2-year yield, instead of going up on the announcement that there's going to be a tapering and then interest rate hikes, in fact, contracted. And we continue to see that the yield curve spread is contracting as well. And generally speaking, when the yield curve spread is contracting, it is reflecting a benign environment for asset prices. And Wall Street has been quite volatile over the course of the last week, but so far at least the Nasdaq continues to hold the region of the 200-day moving average. And I think we'll look at some of those charts before the end of this broadcast, but I think I would like to focus on interest rates and bonds for the and currencies for that matter for the short term. Now, I think the most important point about the yield curve is that it looks like it's peaked, and this peak is substantially lower. It's at a rate that's half of where it peaked in the past. So it implies that there's going to be a shorter cycle, that we're unlikely to have a 10-year expansion following the pandemic. And we're now down to 76 and a bit basis points. And ultimately, this yield curve looks like it will become inverted at some point in the next 18 months. And after that, it's a lead indicator for a future recession of anything from 9 to 18 months. So, worst case scenario, or I guess best case scenario, there's going to be a recession at some point in 2024. Well, when we then think about what that means, well, it does suggest that between now and when you get the inversion, stock markets tend to do well. But there's a lot of fear around right now. And of course, that's also benign for markets. So when we think about the consistency that we see in these stock markets, well, we might be in for a period of increased volatility. And there's certainly the question about just how much can they really raise rates? They can talk about raising rates, but there aren't many countries have succeeded in raising rates more than once. So the UK raised rates by a quarter of a point in here this week, and the pound rallied for 2 days, and then it started giving it up in here today. And I think it's still accurate to say that there's no country particularly wants a strong currency, but right now, the USA is doing more to support its currency than other countries are. And the euro remains quite weak. And Europe in particular has been conspicuous by not raising rates and not attempting to talk down inflationary pressures. So they want a weaker currency more than most. So that's weighing on the euro, and the euro continues to trend lower in a consistent manner, and this was a dynamic move that we saw in here today. So I think this is also a rather interesting development. So when we think then about what the medium-term potential is, well, if you're going to have a decline in the dollar and look and focus on the unattractive fiscal condition, or the fact that the government isn't going, they're talking about raising rates, but they probably won't be able to do it. Well, those are paling into insignificance compared to the efforts by the Eurozone to attempt to devalue their currency. And if the dollar is going to decline, well, then it has to decline against something. So something else has to go up. And the renminbi has been really strong over most of 2021, but it has paused over the course of the last couple of weeks. And a good part of the reason why the renminbi has been so firm has been because of the reluctance of the Chinese administration to engage in the same kind of fiscal stimulus that much of the rest of the world, and particularly the major economies, engaged in. And the big question for 2022 is how sustainable is that? Are they going to continue to tolerate the downward pressure that we're seeing in some of the portions of the property market and the CSI real estate sector has been just about hanging on at the lower side of a 6-year range for the last 3 months, and we've had a couple of dynamic moves in that time as well. So obviously it's going to be important that it hold the lows, and so far there's a preponderance of downward dynamics. We've had one upward dynamic, and that was the most recent. But it's still encountering resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. And if it sustains a move below the lows and below the 6,000 level, well, then that's going to be, I think, a sign that people are beginning to lose faith in the, I think, conjecture that the Chinese government is going to ride to the rescue. And I think this is one of the most important points, because there's been a lot of speculation that the USA's Powell put has eroded, but there's absolutely no evidence of that. I mean, the stock market is only down about 3 or 4% off the peak, and it would be unreasonable to expect the central bank to even think about riding to the rescue without a decline of anywhere between 10 and 20%. And unless we start to see the stock market pull back by at least that margin, and then see no action by the central bank in the US, I think it's just too early to even begin to talk about the absence of a Powell put. But it's particularly relevant to talk about the absence of a communist put in the market, because the Communist Party in China has rode to the rescue of the property sector for on every little pullback for years. So we're in a situation today where they're trying to instill discipline on the sector. And we're seeing an increasing number of these companies going bust, and ultimately it's going to play a role in the not only economic growth but the perception among consumers about just what economic growth potential is going to be like. So investors are beginning to price in the potential that 2022 is going to be the year when the Chinese party, or the Communist Party, decide that they're going to ease off on the property sector. So, when we think about the CSI 300, it popped on the upside earlier this week. It came straight back down into the range, in here today. But it's still trading more or less above the trend mean. And if it can rebound again on Monday, and over the holiday, well, then that's going to be supportive of the view that investors at least believe that the Chinese government is going to ride to the rescue of the property market. And then we also saw that Mexico raised interest rates by 50 basis points in here this week as well. And the peso has arrested its decline. So we had a significant devaluation in 2020. It unwound all of it, and it was starting to weaken again 4 weeks ago, but it's now retraced most of that devaluation. So it's quite likely that the Mexican peso could strengthen further from here. And of course, Mexico is a major energy producer and a major silver producer, and it also has a number of industrial resources exports as well. So as we start to see infrastructure development taking off next year, and particularly with the reorientation of the global economy towards more of a green agenda, then that's likely to be beneficial for countries that can export copper. Well, Bolivia is also one of those countries that could potentially benefit, and Peru is another country that could potentially benefit, and Southern Copper is, and I'm not sure how that did work, and Southern Copper is right in the region of the lows from back in September, and testing the region of the 200-day moving average, and the copper price continues to consolidate in the region of the all-time peaks, and it steadied from the trend mean in here this week. So as long as that remains the case, we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And there are whole new sources of demand emerging for copper. And historically, the copper was not really influenced by the transportation sector. But now we have a lot more demand for copper from the automotive sector, and the electric vehicles that are being produced today require 3 times more copper than internal combustion engines. And then, of course, we look at the total tonnage of copper that's in every one of the wind turbines that's produced, and that represents, it's upwards, I think it's of a ton per megawatt in terms of the size of those motors in those big turbines. And I saw this chart in here today, which I thought was particularly relevant because the cost of generating electricity has been trending downwards, and the cost of delivering that electricity has been trending upwards, and it has basically doubled in a decade. So it's up to now about 4 cents per kilowatt hour. Well, when we then think about, well, what does that mean? Well, the first thing is, of course, that we have a lot more distributed power now. And all those wind turbines and solar arrays, they need extra. Not, it doesn't just represent generating capacity, but it also requires the electrical grid to be expanded in order to incorporate them. And that's increasing the cost. So if we were to add these together, well, this was, let's say, a bit more than 6, and back here was about 2, so that would have been about 8. And now, if we look at current prices, they're both in the region of about 4, which is also 8. So basically, right now, we have got costs that are levelized with about where they were in 2010, even though the cost of generating the electricity has declined. And these trends, they may not compress further in the case of the generating capacity, but it looks likely that the cost of delivery will continue to trend higher. It looks like a very consistent trend, whereas we've had more variability in the cost of generating, and it's been both up and down over the course of the last 5 years. So this also represents an additional draw on copper, because copper wires are the most efficient in terms of those high tension cables. And then, of course, we have the clear trend also of developing subsea cabling to trend or to export electricity from different countries. And there are a large number of subsea cables for electricity transportation underway in all over the world, and that represents another significantly large draw on copper. And then we can think about infrastructure development, because that's been the classic source of demand. Well, I think it's interesting that China Steel has been ranging now for the last, or I guess it's pulled back for most of 2020, and it's been steadying of late. And if we just simply put this on a line chart and then zoom out, we can see that the hot rolled steel sheet price got all the way up to test the 2008 and 2004 peaks, and it's now pulled back somewhat, but it has certainly not unwound all of the advance that we saw off the lows in 2016. So there's been a lot of speculation about just how willing the Chinese government is to really cut back on excess steel production. And we've definitely had some of that. And China is certainly attempting to be more green oriented. And the confidence that that's given ArcelorMittal, I think it might be indicative of the fact that China is willing to cut back on some of that inefficient steel production, which should then help to support the steel price domestically, because ArcelorMittal is beginning to raise prices for its products. So the share was up in a dynamic manner in here this week, but it's been in this lengthy base formation for a decade. And there's been periods of extraordinary volatility where it's gone from 30 to 5 in a round trip fashion on two occasions. But even still, we're at still a fraction of where prices were back in 2007 and 8. And there's the real potential that what we're looking at today is a significant infrastructure development trend. Because if we're talking about building a whole new green energy sector, and particularly in Europe, they have a clear incentive to attempt to become energy independent. From the UK's perspective, it's more about becoming energy independent once more. And they certainly now know what it feels like to no longer be energy independent, and the kind of volatility we've had in terms of energy prices over the course of the last few months will have rammed that point home. So we can certainly anticipate that there will be additional measures put in place to become energy independent. And so far, the bet that's been taken is to double down on wind and to build battery backup power. And that battery backup power is going to be expensive. It's considerably more expensive than building natural gas storage. But because the natural gas is no longer majority produced domestically and it's an import, there's just not the same political will to invest in that kind of infrastructure. And that's quite separate from the argument about climate change and the need to, I think, approach or the ambition to approach a net zero condition. And Europe then is in a difficult position as well. France this week said that they've closed down four of their nuclear reactors, and there was a problem with one of the reactors, so they closed down a second one to check, and they found a problem with that as well. So then they closed down two others with the same design, just to make sure that they're not exposing anyone to a problem. But of course, that's restricting a significant source of base load. So we've definitely seen a really significant advance in natural gas prices over the course of the last few months. And natural gas in Europe is now more expensive than it is in Asia. So that will start to encourage cargoes into the European market. And we saw a significant pullback today because Russia announced that they're going to, or they've booked more capacity. But the price rebounded off the lows because the Nord Stream 2 pipeline isn't likely to be permissioned anytime within the next 6 months. So there is still a supply deficit. But one thing that we did see today was that the carbon credits price pulled back rather sharply and it didn't rebound. So we've had a meaningful contraction now and it's rapidly unwinding the overbought condition relative to the trend mean. And the price is up in an incredibly abrupt manner over the course of the last 12 months. So it wouldn't be at all surprising that having got all the way up to test the politically stated ambition of approaching 100 euro, that we might get some consolidation, because it's obviously a point where people are going to ask what's next. But the bigger point, of course, is that it's a politically motivated price. So how low can we anticipate that prices will get? Because the entire European green ambition is to ensure that carbon prices are trading at sufficiently high prices to encourage substitution. So I think it's unlikely that this carbon price is going to come all the way back down to test the region of the trend, to do anything other than test the region of the trend mean. I don't think it's going to come back below it. Now, if we then think about if we've looked at the USA and the UK and Mexico, and we've thought about some of the commodities, but I think it's also worth highlighting that not every country is raising rates. And the Turkish lira is accelerating lower, and it has basically halved in value since September. So, the Turkish Central Bank intervened in the market about 2 weeks ago, and that bought a brief period of stability. But they cut interest rates today, and the stock market pulled back in a very abrupt fashion, and it basically highlights that, and I think this is really relevant, that the stock market went was capable of reflecting the devaluation of the currency over the course of the last while, but then had this massive downside key reversal today. So this is rather odd that we get an environment where the stock market is capable of reflecting the devaluation of the currency, and then it pulls back at even just a brief point where the lira didn't continue lower. But the most important thing is that the normal course of events in any other country would be that when you get inflation running at this level and you get a currency crisis, that the central bank would step in and attempt to arrest the decline, and then subsequently would raise rates. But Erdogan, who is in a de facto dictator, is of the view that higher interest rates cause inflation, which of course runs counter to the experience of every other country in the world. And he is basically instructing the central bank to cut rates. And that has resulted in the stock market pulling back in a violent manner. And when we then adjust that for currency, well, the price of domestic assets is contracting in a really abrupt fashion, and the stock market is right back on its lows. So this is, I think, an important point here, that we're at a point now where the Turkish market could break downwards again, and ultimately, there is the potential that Turkey is going the same way as Argentina. So this obviously represents incredible mismanagement from an economic perspective. And it's also the result of the populist agenda that Erdogan has been pursuing in order to retain power. And it's unsustainable in the short term. The asset that has been holding up best for Turkish investors has been gold. And when we think about gold in terms of Turkish lira, it has done spectacularly well and doubled in the same period of time that the currency halved. So it has been the go-to asset from a local perspective. And of course, Bitcoin has also held up admirably in local currency terms. And gold prices rebounded off their lows in here this week and are finishing out the week just around the $1,800 area, although slightly below it. We've had the price really not going anywhere for 3 weeks, and arguably the price hasn't gone anywhere for most of the last 6 months with a bit of volatility around that range, but the 200-day moving average is practically a straight line around the $1,800 area. Ultimately, gold is being constrained by the reasonable strength of the dollar, and it's doing better in just about every other currency. So when we think about the euro and the weakness that we're seeing right now, well, gold is now looking like a first step above this base that was put in most of 2021, and the pound has a reasonably similar pattern overall and finding support in the region of the trend mean. A number of weaker currencies also have similar patterns, and the real and the Mexican peso have been reasonably steady over the last few months. So gold is still right in the region of the trend mean, but at least finding support there. And then, of course, we have the renminbi, which has been particularly firm. So gold is steadying from the lower side of the range there. It's not breaking down in any currency. And we saw in here this week that gold shares failed to sustain the move below $30 and rebounded in an emphatic fashion. So I think this is quite encouraging action. And it suggests that over the period from now through to the end of the year, when large numbers of people will be on vacation, that there's the clear potential that we're going to have an uptick in volatility. Now, volatility in the stock market, certainly potential, but the currency markets are also a potential source of volatility. And the VIX index came all the way back down from the test of 35 and has now steadied in the region of the 200-day moving average. And I think that we're at a point now where people are beginning to question the sustainability of the advance on the Nasdaq and its ability to continue to advance when there are questions about the continued growth and the interest rate sensitivity of the mega caps. But the Nasdaq trend is still consistent, and it's still holding the sequence of ranges one above another, and it's holding this region here in the area of the upper side of this range. And I do want to just look at this on a daily chart. So we can definitely see that the most consistent thing about the chart on the Nasdaq has been the sequence of ranges one above another. And as long as that remains the case, we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. Ultimately, a secular bull market is defined by the ability of the index to find support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average during corrective phases. But it's been an awfully long time since the Nasdaq came anywhere close to the 1,000-day moving average. The last time was back in 2009. And I think this is one of the most important parallels, that the market today has the potential to move into a really bubbly phase. But in order for that to happen, then we're going to have to continue to see extraordinarily loose monetary and liquidity conditions. And what that suggests is that prior to a bubble forming, we would need to see a pullback in the order of about 10 to 20%, and then the Federal Reserve in particular abandon their plans to stop quantitative easing, and they would have to pull back from any plans to raise rates, and that subsequently they would infuse the market with lots of liquidity and asset prices would start to inflate once more. But we're not quite there yet in terms of the underperformance of the Fangman plus Tesla index. So when we look at this relative or this ratio of those 8 shares compared to the NYSE's market cap, well, it pulled back in a violent manner this week, but it's still holding the 22% level. So those 8 shares still represent 22% of the total market cap of the NYSE. And that's more or less the upper side of the range. So we're at a point where if these shares are going to find support, they're going to find support potentially over the winter break and begin to re-accelerate higher in the new year. We can think about companies like Microsoft, where the size of the pullback has been extremely modest, and there has been clear evidence of acceleration over the course of the period up from September through November, but it's still got the sequence of higher reaction lows. And when we think about this on a long-term chart, well, it really only broke out of its base formation in 2013, and since then, it really hasn't looked back. So this is one of the big differences between the late 1990s and today, because ultimately, companies like Cisco Systems were industrially oriented and highly cyclical in the late 1990s. And Microsoft was a highly cyclical company in the 1990s because they were reliant on releasing a new version of Microsoft Word or Excel or Windows on a set time frame. But then they adopted a subscription business model in 2013, and instead of selling the next new version of software, then you now have Microsoft 365. So then they're constantly improving that, and we pay for it every month instead of buying it on a once-off basis. So that then expands the potential for clients because more people can afford to pay something every month rather than the bigger outlay once every couple of years. And then, of course, that speaks very clearly to the kind of condition that we're in right now, where people literally don't have the capital, and the business models have evolved to just treat everybody as a series of cash flows. But what it has done is insulate these companies from the same kind of cyclicality that they were susceptible to in the Y2K period. So the kinds of companies that are cyclical are going to be the semiconductor companies because there's been an enormous draw on their productive capacity over the course of the pandemic. And we're at a point now, and this is not in local currency terms, we're at a point now where the market is beginning to question whether we're going to have continued strength or whether we're going to have a period of oversupply. Because Taiwan Semiconductor said that they were going to massively increase the production of microcontrollers by the end of the year, and they have followed through on that. So it has also allowed lots of companies to say that their supply chain problems will probably have been resolved by the end of the second quarter. Although it's certainly not true of all companies, because I got notice today that the refrigerator and freezer that we ordered back in June and were expecting to take delivery of on Monday has been delayed until March. Certainly Wolf refrigerators are not in that bracket of having solved most of their supply chain issues. But of course, what it also helps to suggest is that there are plenty of companies with significant order backlogs, and that also suggests that they're going to still have strong sales persisting, even if they are in cyclical sectors. So there's still strong demand for white goods and for the kinds of non, or I guess the durable goods are the ones that obviously have had the biggest jump in demand, and there is still strong demand even if it is highly cyclical. And that helps to suggest that there's perhaps still some room on the upside for these shares to continue to perform. But of course, that is dependent on the trends remaining consistent. And right now, the semiconductor index is in the region of the trend mean. So this is an ideal area where, if it's going to find support, it really should be doing that. And when we think about the longer term, well, if we think back to the yield curve spread, we could potentially have a recession at some point in the next few years. And one thing that I think is relevant to pay attention to is the high yield spread, because companies have had the opportunity to refinance. So if high yield spreads start breaking through 500 basis points, it's going to be indicative of a wider problem in the credit environment. And the other thing, of course, is that the financial sector does well in a higher interest rate environment. But banks were not stronger this week, and Goldman Sachs was among the biggest decliners on the in here today. And the S&P 500 banks index is below its trend mean and pulling back from it, and made a new low in here today. And if we just look at that Goldman chart, well, it's not trending higher. In fact, it hasn't really gone anywhere for most of the last 6 months. And let me put that on the 10-year weekly chart, and it's looking tired. So if we're not going to see yields pushing higher, and we're not going to see the bond market giving credence to the potential that the Federal Reserve can follow through and raise rates, and not least because of the pressure that would come to bear on the servicing costs for governments, because most governments saw their debt servicing costs decline in 2020 and then rebound in 2021. So if yields were to move higher from here, well, then we'd be at new all-time highs for the cost of servicing the debt, and still have historically very low yields. So it's very difficult for central banks to do anything other than token interest rate hikes. And we would need to see really considerable strength in the economy and in demand for credit and supply of credit and risk-taking behavior and really strong economic activity in order to justify the continued swell in support for raising interest rates. And with bank stocks not performing, well, that is a bit of a warning, because banks don't have to be the best performing sector, but they do well in a rising interest rate environment. In fact, the financials overall, they do tend to do best and are among the best performing sectors in a rising interest rate environment. And the financial spider was also weaker in here this week. Now, back in 2006 and 7, there were people talking about the bubble in US housing. And living in London at the time and not having direct exposure to it, it was hard to really gauge the magnitude of how big the bubble had become. But one thing that I think is interesting right now is that we're starting to see this emerging sector in the financials, in the buy now, pay later environment. So Affirm is one of the bigger ones, and it was listed earlier this year. So at least we've got a year of history. And it's now in the region of the upper side of the base put in between about February and August of this year. But we've had a meaningful pullback coming from 170 and change down to 100. So if it's going to find support, then this would be an ideal point for that to happen. And PayPal has also pulled back in a really quite dynamic manner and was down for consecutive weeks and has, well, not quite halved, but it's not all that far away from that either. So this is obviously a significant break of trend. Now, part of the reason for that has been the weakness we've seen in the cryptocurrencies sector. And there's the world of difference between deposit-taking institutions that borrow at the short end, lend at the long end, and pick up the spread, and those that are borrowing a ton of money in order to fund growth. So the banks are looking considerably better supported, even though they are looking weaker recently than some of these fintech companies. And then, of course, you have companies like Square, which has doubled down on blockchain and called itself Block Inc. now. So this has also broken downwards and has not rebounded in a sufficiently impressive manner in here this week in order to really demonstrate that a low has been found. So this is something that we do need to pay attention to, because the buy now and pay later environment is the equivalent of the subprime environment, because it's making credit available to people that wouldn't normally have it made available to them. So it's a younger demographic, that's certainly one part of it. And then it's also people that don't have control over their finances, don't have a history of being able to borrow and pay back money. Now, of course, it doesn't represent quite the same size of asset and credit that we had with mortgages, but it's potentially more broad-based. And this buy now, pay later situation is now found. If we look on the vast majority of retail sites, now we're starting to see these pay in four easy payments of $12.95 for something that only costs $60. And this kind of provision of liquidity and the extraordinarily high interest rates if someone misses a payment means that it's requiring large numbers of people to be very responsible. It's increasing their exposure in terms of credit. And because there's no interest rate and because it's not considered a credit card, it's probably not going to show up in some of those delinquency type of data series. So it's a new phenomenon overall. And we're going to see the end of LIBOR in the new year. So that's going to remove an additional source of, or it's an additional way of monitoring stress in the market. So if we look at, for example, the OIS spread, well, the most important thing is that it has turned around. So it contracted from the peak in 2020, and it isn't contracting any longer. Now, it's not at an egregious level. We're only talking about 12 basis points. But the OIS spread breaking out and holding a higher level, most particularly above the 50 basis point level in 2007, it was indicative of problems in the banking sector. And it's the difference between the OIS spread, or the swap spread, and the 3 year, or excuse me, 3 month yield. So at least this is not reliant on LIBOR, because LIBOR is no longer going to be a market set rate. SOFR is going to be set by the government or by the central bank. So we're moving increasingly further away from market set rates. And this is just another step down the road towards financial repression. We're already in an environment where banks and insurance companies and pensions are being forced to own government bonds. We're already at a point where the government is telling the lenders who and what sectors they can lend to, and by creating the carbon credit market, that is assigning an order of priorities to investors, what they're allowed to invest in, what they can't, and what they lend to, and what they can't. So it doesn't necessarily mean that they have to take over the banks. They can just regulate them in such a way that banks have to perform in a way that is permissible and desirable by the government. So we're likely to remain in a negative real interest rate environment for the lengthy medium term. And that has been one of the primary rationales for why the stock market has continued to inflate, because it helps asset prices. But that's, of course, contingent on banks continuing to do well. So I think it's also important to pay attention to how banks are performing internationally. And the Euro Stoxx Banks Index has been resurgent over the course of the last year, and it's been in a base formation for a decade. And even within that base formation, there has been a clear downward bias where we have lower highs and lower lows. So it's got to do more. And most particularly, it's got to break the sequence of lower rally highs in order to demonstrate a return to demand dominance. And it's still likely that the European banking sector is going to remain under pressure. And they've certainly made a lot of headway in terms of non-performing loans, and that the efforts to tackle that problem have been accelerated of late. But still, you need credit growth to really kick off in order to reinvigorate the banking sector. And you still have an environment in Europe of negative real interest rates and negative nominal interest rates. And how are banks supposed to make money in that environment is anybody's guess. And the TOPIX Banks Index in Japan is still steadying in the region of the trend mean. And the second section is steadying in the region of the trend mean and the upper side of the range that's been forming for the last 4 years. So this is also an important area where support needs to start to come back in order to demonstrate that we're still in a demand-dominated environment. The Indian banking sector has pulled back over the course of the last few weeks and is approaching the region of the trend mean. So we're still in a corrective phase for India. But India's in a new credit cycle, and that's where you're going to see increasing demand for credit, which should help asset price appreciation. So this doesn't look like anything other than a brief period of underperformance, which will allow I guess the easy way to say it is that it's a pause that renews, and India is best bought following these occasional shakeouts, and that looks like what we're seeing right now. And of course, the reason for that is that the RBI has been shy about raising rates, and the rupee broke downwards over the last 2 weeks. So it's certainly going to be interesting to see, is the rupee going to break down again to new all-time lows, or are we going to see some action from the RBI to arrest the decline? But the Modi government is certainly on a path towards greater fiscal spending in order to boost economic growth. And India is likely to be the growth or the dynamic growth center of the next decade, with the demographic dividend starting to come into effect and greater manufacturing prowess, and particularly as companies attempt to migrate away from the influence of China. I remain of the view that infrastructure is likely to be a significant trend over the next decade, and India will be a very big part of that as we see it increasingly move towards industrialization. Of course, 2021 saw more coal burned on a global basis than ever before, and that is despite the rhetoric about the end of coal. And it's probably going to be at least a decade before we see the significant investments in alternative energy really coming to fruition. And the oil price has weakened somewhat over the course of the last week, and it's now pulling back to test the area or the region of the 200-day moving average. So if this trend is going to rebound, because it isn't really as consistent as it was before. So we've had a deeper pullback, and we've pulled back into the underlying base, into the underlying range. So if it's going to bounce from here, well, this is the time for that to happen. There's obviously the potential that we're going to have a slower growth environment in the short term as central banks begin to raise rates and start to think about removing liquidity. Normally, stock markets do well after the first interest rate hike, and then subsequently, the influence of additional interest rate hikes begins to weigh on investor sentiment. But we're in a very liquidity-dependent market environment, and that suggests that the interest rate sensitivity of the market is greater now than it has been in the past. So we've seen significant pullbacks for the kinds of assets that are most interest rate sensitive, and the SPAC index pulled back in a violent manner this week and then began to find at least short-term support over the last couple of days. And then Bitcoin has been also in a clear corrective phase. Now, the price was down an additional 1,500 points, or dollars, I should say, in here today. And this trend up from the lows in June is no longer consistent. It has pulled back into the underlying range, and the size of the pullback from the peak is larger than any pullback we've seen since May. So it's quite normal to see Bitcoin rolling over about a year after a halving. And the halving, was in 2020. So the time when Bitcoin tends to do best is after a halving, but only in the year after the halving. And then we move into a deeper process of ranging and consolidation. And it looks increasingly likely that that's what's going on right now. So it's going to be a more difficult environment for Bitcoin, just from a cyclical perspective. But the speculation that goes into Bitcoin tends to be very interest rate dependent and liquidity dependent. So it's also a lightning rod for liquidity. And if we start to see liquidity starting to deteriorate, well, then it's likely we're going to see it first in the cryptocurrencies. And well, we are seeing that in the cryptocurrencies. And I think Ethereum is also rather interesting because we had the big upside key reversal on Wednesday and no real follow-through yet, but it has not broken down either. But it's closing out the week below the 4,000 level. Now, if gold is potentially going to be volatile over the Christmas period, then it's also reasonable to anticipate that cryptocurrencies will also be volatile in an environment where many people take vacations. And these markets trade 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, irrespective of public holidays. So enterprising traders will be up early on Christmas Day to attempt to try and influence these markets because of low liquidity and stop levels. So it's certainly likely that we're going to have really volatile trading environments where traders will try to trigger stops. So it's certainly a market that's worth keeping an eye on because it's extremely likely that we're going to have a big move at some point over the next 2 and 3 weeks. I think as we think about the long term, we're in an environment where central banks are talking about raising rates, some are doing it, but the market, and particularly the bond market, doesn't really believe that they're going to be able to follow through. And because of that, it's helping to support the dollar, it's supporting the asset prices, particularly the NASDAQ, and people are worried about liquidity, which is why financials are beginning to experience some pressure on the downside. I think one of the big questions for 2022 is going to be what happens with China. If they do come through with fiscal stimulus, then that is going to be sufficiently large because capital is both global and mobile to help stock markets globally find support and start to recover again. If, on the other hand, they really do follow through on what they said they're going to do and snuff out speculation in the property market in China, that could have global repercussions. And we're already seeing that countries like Turkey are rolling over, and Argentina seems to be in perpetual problems. But these won't be the only countries that experience stress if we don't see new sources of liquidity evolving. So we're certainly in a more risky environment overall. But as long as the NASDAQ remains reasonably consistent, we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And we don't yet have an inverted yield curve. So it is likely that this is not anything other than a reversion to the mean and a somewhat lengthier consolidation following an extraordinarily powerful period on the upside. And I think if we just look at that S&P 500 chart where we've had this incredible advance up from the lows in March of 2020, it really wouldn't be all that surprising to see a lengthier period of pause and consolidation so that some of the overvaluation can be unwound and for the next source of liquidity to reinflate asset prices to evolve as well. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.